All right, thank you, Conway Lawrence. Well, I think we've got quite a considerable amount of time in which you can deal with the questions and discussion. And so I think we can enter right into it. And anybody who wishes to ask a question or contribute towards what has been said on the subject of alienation by making some short contribution, it's over to you.
Nobody? Oh, for Christ's sake, I did take...
Well, there are some of us, but we are deferring to visitors.
Oh.
We hope perhaps the chairman would encourage non-members to get their paper first.
Yeah, but quite often, if a member opens up, it encourages visitors to open up. So, you know, all depends how you look at it.
Well, I mean, if nobody will, I'll start with all of them, only because nobody will.
So you're a member.
You've got to be kidding me. First of all, I don't say this because it's comment Lawrence, and I did take the opportunity this afternoon to read through the article on alienation in his famous 1844 so-called Soviet political menu. And I don't propose, I did make many notes of them, and I don't propose to read them all out now, except to say that if you take the trouble to read them, in my opinion, Lawrence is absolutely correct. The whole content and essence of the thing, he starts off by saying that he's going to deal with it from the point of view of the political economists. And the whole thing is based on economics. And he points out the fallacies of the economists in connection with all the things that Pete's been explaining. Pointing out the things that happen. Even if my activity is a scientific one, an activity that I've consulted for directly in company with other men, I'm still acting socially since I'm acting as a man. Not only the material of my activity, like language itself for the thinker, is given to me as a social product. My own existence is social activity. Therefore, what I individually produce, I produce individually for society, conscious of myself as a social being, and so on and so forth. One could go on indefinitely. So that I would entirely subscribe to what Peter said, and take the view that anybody who dismisses these early arguments as I wouldn't call them raving, but as the immature expressions of a young student, it wasn't quite clear. I would conclude that entirely the opposite is the case, and if you read it through carefully, I can only conclude about the same thing.
Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'd like to ask the speaker if he could comment on the problem of making people aware of their role and in society and the nature of their thoughts and attitudes and all that, which he quite rightly demonstrates is these all thoughts, attitudes, behaviour patterns are permeated by the extent of the alienation which exists. Could he tell us what his own thoughts are on difficulties, possibilities of getting through that barrier which is now so deeply entrenched that it is patently only a few oddballs and exceptional people, I don't mean exceptional in any status sense, but one might say exceptionally lucky people who happen to have had the experience or a good mentor or read the right books, who have seen through it. The veil of mystery and alienation and detachment and erroneous beliefs is so impenetrable in most people's minds that I wonder if he has any encouraging comments or recommendations to make as to how to get through what has become a worldwide madhouse, not only in the sort of physical sense of the world itself, but what is going on in people's minds.
No, I've absolutely no words of encouragement in that direction whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I'm very, very pessimistic. Like Marx in his own time, I think he was very, very optimistic. I was at Buick's lecture here a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke of the way in which he thought the working class would develop through trade unionism, first of all, and Marx lent quite a hand to the trade union movement, and then to the winning of political freedoms, and then eventually to the act of political revolution and the establishment of socialism. But certainly that projected timetable has not worked out at all. And when I first joined the party, it was a common belief amongst members, about the time Les joined, he'll remember it, that, well, the contradictions of capitalism will become so obvious to people that surely, you know, human beings who, after all, must have an interest in solving their own problems will see these contradictions for what they are. But if you look around the world now, in 1980, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the contradictions of capitalism are being recognised by people, is there? They are becoming more intense, I would think. And certainly this experience of alienation that I've outlined, the total paralysing of these enormous productive powers that have been built up under capitalism because of the nature of productive relationships and the whole object of capitalist society, the accumulation of capital, there seems to be no grounds for optimism at all. I think we are in a madhouse. This extent to which what Marx called the fetishism of commodities, to which it's gained a real mental grip on people's minds, I think is very, very complete. The idea, you know, that commodities, wealth, production, profit and all something take on a life of their own, that they have a material reality independent of human beings, and you should accept them for what they are as being something material, fixed and unalterable. And the complete inability to see that commodities, what stamps wealth as commodities, is only an expression of the particular relationships between human beings. I see no progress towards people recognising that at all. And yet, on other accounts, they're rather bizarre examples, I know. But if sometimes you get examples of human beings, albeit for the wrong reasons and quite hideous causes, some of the fervour, I think, that went into this Falkland Islands thing, although it's totally misplaced, there was a feeling that people were getting together on some sort of basis of real community. I don't know. I mean, I remember the workers in the docks, whether they were motivated by more overtime pay or not. But they worked very, very hard to get those ships out to sea and all that sort of thing. They were quite unstinting. So sometimes you see, you know, aspects of human behaviour which, you know, sort of remind you in a very, very distant way that human beings are capable of establishing a genuine community in their own interests. But in general grounds, I'm very, very pessimistic. Very pessimistic indeed. I agree with your description. I think capitalism is an institutionalised insane asylum.
Well,
aspects of religion. When does this actually come into in this society of Marx and those other people that you read earlier on religion as regards this new society of theirs?
What socialism, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, religion is inconsistent with socialism. Its whole view of human history and the attitude taken by the church on social issues has been very, very hostile to the socialist attitude.
Would they be able to practice religions as such?
Well, socialism will be a very, very tolerant society, obviously. And if there's any residue of... I'm not one of those members who thinks we're going to establish... socialism with every member of the human family having thoroughly read up on the materialist conception of history. I don't believe that at all. I think the level at which people, the intellectual level at which people can become socialists, falls a long way short of a study in depth of Marxist writings and the whole Marxist literature. falls a long way short of that. And if you think about it, that in principle, there is nothing actually to prevent somebody who believes in God from actually cooperating with other human beings about production for use on the basis of equality and cooperation. But politically speaking, we're hostile to the church and we don't admit religious members.
I think that Comrade Lawrence has introduced quite a large number of concepts and ideas which you could take up in order to discuss this subject of alienation in a broader sense. You know, I mean, in order to encourage you, when you think about it, you've talked about the effect, for instance, of literature and art, the way in which they conceive this alienation. He's talked about the effect of technology. But I think one of the important things that you should try and start from, if you start from the proposition that early primitive societies, because they had this continual sympathy with nature itself, that worked with nature, and that nature and man, or nature and human society had to react to nature, that nature had natural wealth which they could use in order to make it of use to them. This relationship that took place, and along with it, the development of technology, has, over into the, with the development of capitalism, separated man from the means of production. It separated him not only from natural wealth, it separated him from the means of changing that natural wealth into useful wealth, in the sense that primitive societies would have done. So here's a basis from which you can start. And you can think about your own lives, perhaps, and how does it affect you, this society? How do you feel estranged from the being able to exercise your mental and physical abilities and so on?
Well, Comrade General, I think Peter Lawrence has advanced two completely different theories of alienation. And somewhere in the middle of his talk, he's woven them into one, or the assumption that there's one theory of alienation. Because when he talks about people being alienated from themselves, and the individual being alienated from himself or herself, I don't frankly know what he means. In philosophical terms, I think this is a bit of a compromise. What is the self or the individual to which he refers? But then when he talks about a social essence, that human beings are only a social essence, in other words, if I want to know myself, I can only do so by reflecting upon other people. I do not have, as far as I am aware, a self, and therefore I don't feel either alienated from it or attached to it. I don't think that there is such a thing as a self. There is a material composition which only differentiates me or makes me similar from other people in social terms. So whilst I'll go along with everything that he says on the second conception of alienation, I'd like him to go into greater detail on the first one, because I think that it belongs to philosophical individualism, which in fact is a way of looking at human relationships, which Marx would have done, and socialists certainly should, completely reject.
I don't think you can possibly deny that in individuals, the experience of feeling that the life you are leading is not an expression of one's own authentic self is a fairly common experience under capitalism. For example, I think the division of labour under capitalism imposes work routines on people to which they have to conform for all sorts of economic reasons, reasons of economic necessity, but ones which they're not necessarily happy with and which they don't see as being individually fulfilling. I don't think you can possibly deny that. So I think the feeling of individual alienation, that what I'm doing is not an expression of what I feel I should be doing or how I see myself, is a very, very common experience under capitalism. One of the problems with writers, psychologists and artists and writers and that, who treat of the experience of alienation at the level of individuality, is that, of course, they don't do the very thing which Steve said we should do, and that is to place the experience in its social context, which is one of the reasons why I'm saying that Marx's treatment of the subject is so important. It is Marx who did treat the thing in its social context, in its historical context, and in the context of particular productive relationships. And so that the individual experience of alienation, which may not be understood unless it is seen in this context, Marx's work, therefore, is very, very valuable in this connection. No, I mean, if he's saying that alienation cannot be totally and completely explained as a totally individual experience, then of course I agree with him. One of the whole objects of the talk is to show how Marx put this in its total social context. One of the things that psychologists and others who deal with a lot of people who are suffering acute stress and feelings of meaninglessness in their life, they're totally unable to put these things in their true social perspective. And even if they could, there's absolutely nothing they could do about it. I mean, we're lumbered with capitalism, and you have to put up with all the social consequences of it. I don't know if we can take that a bit further and suggest the ways in which, you know, socialist society would in fact be more inclined to end this.
I mean, I read it, I can't remember the text of it, but surely what Volker Schross was rejecting was the metaphysical overtones, the philosophy elevated to a metaphysical type of explanation, metaphysical, philosophical explanation or analysis, which was separated from, divorced from real experiences and the social context. And that perhaps Marx did either intentionally or unintentionally, or perhaps through a bad choice of words, occasionally give the impression that there was some inner spiritual self or a self separate from and capable of being controlled, manipulated, diverted or directed, separate from the social context. And that if and where Marx did give that impression, which was bordering on or tending towards a metaphysical concept, that's where Volker Schross was trying to eliminate or reject that aspect. I mean, I can't speak to Schross, but I've no doubt that he would accept that, that it was only in that respect that he was critical, and that in the later, more Marxist analysis in later writings tended perhaps to choose his words more carefully, and to give the correct impression of what his views really were, which are as you have expressed them. But I don't think Schross would disagree with what you have said tonight on the social context and the nature of the productive process and the way that alienates people. And the fact that it all springs from the economic relationships which affect the nature of society as a whole and the nature of the individual.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it, Les. Inevitably, you know, in the intellectual climate of the 1830s and 40s, it takes time, doesn't it, for new ideas to find their own language.
Right, that's right.
I think Steve might have something to say on that theme. I know he's interested in that. But you see, Schross has gone much further. He has actually said that the young Marx first presented the case for socialism based on philosophical humanism, which is a view which is totally erroneous and absolutely contrary to the evidence of Marx's writings at the time. If you take the writings in balance, even taking into account the use of odd phrases like the human essence, species being, and what have you, which were some of the terminology in current use at that period.
Can I just make a point, just a minute, Steve?
I think Clifford wants to comment on
that point. Can I just make a point on why I think this division came about? It was very, historically, it can be explained in this way, that since 1917, with the adoption of Marxist terms and a quite distorted form of Marxism by the leaders of the Russian Revolution, most of the economic and political and historical writings of Marx have been distorted out of all meaning by what became, by the 1930s, an entrenched Stalinist orthodoxy, which had taken over the terms of Marxism and turned them into cliches, which were the opposite of their own meaning. And as a response to this, a group of people who described themselves as Marxists, who were interested in the writings of Marx, who wanted to defend the theories of Lenin, but at the same time wanted to criticize the quite evident failure and tyranny of Stalinism as they saw it, they attempted in the 1930s and 40s to turn to the philosophical writings of Marx, and this whole school of European, primarily German Marxists, as they describe themselves, turned to the philosophical writings of Marx, particularly those of 1844, the Paris manuscripts, and attempted to claim that Marx had nothing whatsoever to do with the economic and political writings which had been used by the Leninists in his name, but was primarily a humanitarian, cultural critique of society. And as a result of that, the Stalinists themselves turned against this conception of Marxism and attempted to, in other words, two conceptions of Marxism, both of which were totally incomplete and incorrect, faced each other. One trying to paint Marx as a humanitarian, a sort of, which was the German, West European conception of non-Stalinist Marxism. The other one, which was the Leninist conception of Marxism, claiming that all of the earlier writings of Marx had nothing to do with the later ones. And in philosophical terms, this became known as the epistemological break. It was claimed that with the writing of the German ideology, which was, I think, in 1846, Marx rejected all of the earlier Hegelian and particularly Feuerbachian ideas of the human essence, and as it was seen by the German school, the sort of humanitarian conception, the humanitarian critique of capitalism. And the trouble is that people have tended to take sides with these two conceptions of Marxism, both of which are incomplete and both of which are wrong. So what this particular writer may well have been doing was he may well have been convinced by those writers who said, look, Marx was not just a humanitarian. He wasn't just making a cultural criticism of society. There are important economic and historical points that he was making. And then there would be other people who would say, no, Marx was more than just an economic determinist. There were important cultural things. And both sides tended to throw out the baby with the bathwater, and all of the rest of the theory were thrown aside. And what is necessary is to come to some sort of dialectical understanding or a complete understanding of Marxism, which recognises that Marx was not simply talking about economic determinism. He wasn't trying to reduce every relationship in society to a simple economic relationship. And at the same time, he wasn't simply throwing away the economic relationships and trying to see alienated relationships in society simply in cultural, humanitarian terms. And I think that that's just one of the many problems which you get in any philosophical polemic, that people tend not to take sides in terms of looking at the complete theory, but tend to take sides with people who have themselves decided to adopt one aspect of the theory or another. And that is why I have reached the conclusion, it may either be an immature conclusion or a mature one, depending on how you look at it, but I have reached the conclusion all Marxist polemic, or self-described Marxist polemic, is far less important than actually turning to what Marx wrote and evaluating it in its own terms, which I think is what this particular writer that you referred to didn't do.
Can I just add to what Steve has said, vis-à-vis Stalin certainly not being keen on the early manuscripts? I think the papers that were in the charge of the Marx Engels Institute at the time, and the head of the institute, the man in charge of the papers, I think it was about 1930, disappeared without trace.
Clifford, do you want
to I'd like to refer to a couple of points which have come up. First on this question of the point of being alienated from yourself. I think there is some point in that, even though it's true that there is no tangible self or individual separate from society, and also the fact that there's no definite human essence that we can point to other than the biological attributes of mankind. All the same, I think there is some point in talking about the problem of being alienated from yourself, in the sense that when labour power, as Peter Lawrence was saying earlier about labour being alienated, when that aspect of a person which is involved in the creation of wealth in the expenditure of labour power has been alienated, in the sense that you're actually selling it to somebody, then obviously one part of you in that sense is being taken away. Also, if you take the extreme case of workers who have to wear a uniform or particular clothing for work, just one example, as soon as that uniform or that clothing is put on, it's a particularly explicit sign of the fact that you're then coming under the sway of the employer. And although it's not a spiritual essence or anything like that, there is this idea of elements of your personality or character which you've developed relatively autonomously, which are then at that moment alienated, in the sense that you're then under the control of the boss or of the company that you're working for. And of course this problem doesn't just end when you go out the factory gates, because then as soon as you go home, if you start to try to take part in some capitalist entertainment, whether it's television or magazines or whatever, again you're being encouraged to have this kind of dual personality, this problem of splitting and fragmenting of the personality, where on the one hand you have elements developing which are relatively autonomous, and you have other elements developing which are most definitely not, because they're almost directly being imposed upon you, cultural elements or fashion or trends which are actually being directly thrown at you. So you have this tension between the two. And that's probably why I think a lot of people genuinely do say things like, I don't feel myself, or that's not me, and this sort of thing. They're not necessarily being religious or individualistic. They're simply saying that there's this tension between what they'd really like to do and what they're forced to do on occasion. So I think that's a fairly valuable concept. The other point I wanted to refer to was something that Peter Lawrence said in answer to an earlier question about the fact that he's pessimistic in that he sees no signs whatsoever of people recognising the contradictions of capitalism, even now. Well, of course, on the one hand, in one sense, he's right in that you can't point your finger and demonstrate definite evidence of a mass understanding of socialism, in the sense that people are actually at this very moment creating a revolution. Realistically recognising that hasn't yet happened. On the other hand, I think we'd be making a great mistake if we fail to recognise the flexibility of ideas and the gradual development of ideas, in the sense that over the last 50 years there have been numerous changes in perception. You can't say they're necessarily backward or forward, or to do so would be very rigid in our interpretation of them, but there have certainly been changes in attitude towards many, many different aspects of social life. And these attitudes have come about as a result of material changes which are still going on. Now, obviously, we can't be too prophetic in trying to chart a very straight line and show that these attitudes are going to change and it's going to lead directly to socialism. But at the same time, there have been advances and there are advances. I mean, for example, in this country alone last year, 5,000 people were registered as having committed suicide, which is a figure like that has never been recorded since the 30s in this country. But those 5,000 people obviously committed suicide for a reason. Now, they may not have had an absolutely clear understanding of capitalism, we don't know, perhaps some did. But they felt sufficiently alienated, or to put it more directly, they felt sufficiently discontent in some way to actually take the step of committing suicide. So the level of discontent is rising. probably is a direct result of the increasing contradictions, of the increasing ability to produce wealth, and the increasing destructive elements and destructive aspects of capitalist society. So that the discontent is there. Whether that leads to understanding can only be perceived by witnessing changing attitudes, however gradual and however indirect they may at first seem. And I think we'd be making a dangerous step if we actually insisted on seeing the question in such rigid black and white terms that we simply say, well, people haven't understood socialism and therefore that's the end of the question. I think it goes a lot deeper than that.
Are there any visitors that wish to come in on this?
I can only say one thing, but he's put forward a point of view that I've never considered in my life, and it's so deep and so profound that I think it wants a hell of a lot of thinking about before you can really talk on it. It enters nearly everything that I've ever thought of, and where I've got it twisted up, it seems to be an outlet.
Anybody else?
Yes, perhaps the optimistic note that Clifford just expressed may be as appropriate as the pessimistic note that Peter voiced. See, if you consider changes, any change that's taken place in the past 50 or 60 years, it indicates the fact that an attitude to some aspect of society has been severely modified. For instance, while Clifford was speaking, I was thinking in my own mind of various changes that have taken place, and one sprang to mind, which may be indicative, I don't know. 60 years ago, it would not have been necessary to print in newspapers like the Daily Mirror, and the Mail, the Express, or popular magazines, instructions on how to get a job, how to approach your employer, what to do at the interview, what clothing to wear, what hairstyle not to embellish yourself with, what attitude you should take, one of deference, of course, to the interviewer. Now, 60 years ago, young people applying for a job would automatically have their best Sunday suit on, they would have had a freshly cut, they would have had a fresh haircut, their collar would have been impeccably, brilliantly white, and they would have had the appropriate, dull, inoffensive tie on. Now then, today, young people who have expressed their individuality in their clothing, their general appearance, and their general attitudes, have to be re-educated into how to conform to the norm or the required style and attitude in order to get a job at a time of mass unemployment. And this perhaps is just one smaller indication of how the individuals do try by all sorts of means to break out of that all-enveloping, stultifying mould, alienated and regimented mould that this system is constantly trying to press us into. There is rebellion, there is protest, and there is optimistic signs here, and there are optimistic signs here and there that people don't always come out of the machine at the other end in exactly the same packaging and shape that was intended.
Can I just say on that, I don't think it makes much sense to talk in terms of somebody being pessimistic and somebody else being optimistic when two people express different theories about development of society. After all, these concepts of pessimistic and optimistic are relatively subjective. I don't think that's the way that this is in fact happening. I was simply arguing that there are social forces beyond our immediate individual control. Nothing any one of us in this room could do or say tonight would make any difference to the fact that there are 3 million people unemployed in this country, just to take one example out of thousands. And those social forces lead to changes. I mean, they always have done, they always will. One thing, these things do lead to change. Now, if, as the Marxist theory would have it, that there is only one logical or future outcome to the capitalist system, which is socialism. In other words, you've got a class struggle which can only lead in victory to one side or the other. At the moment, it's leading to victory to the ruling class, which is why we've still got capitalist society, which is why Peter Lawrence's observations about what he sees around him I have to go along with to that extent. We do still live in capitalism after all these years. So the class struggle carries on, as long as the victory for the ruling class continues. But if that class struggle is ended by the means of production being taken over, then that's the only logical outcome that can result from it. So in other words, I'm saying it's not a matter of whether you think things are looking up or things are looking down. We know there is not yet a mass socialist consciousness, but there is still every sign to suggest that there is going to be, that there is a development towards socialism, however slow, however disheartening at times for those of us who feel that we've reached a certain stage of consciousness which is different from that which other people have achieved. We are simply the, without wishing to sound too deterministic about it, we are simply the puppets of this process. We're simply people who happen to have reached a certain frame of mind. We've reached it for reasons which are still not just present, but present a thousand times more strongly than when Peter Lawrence joined the party, as he said some time ago. Now those forces are even stronger, and they're going to produce people like Peter Lawrence far more in the future than they did in the past, I'm glad to say.
Can't see the evidence right for it. I will say this, you know, that obviously the feelings of frustration are very, very intense. But one of the expressions of frustration, and the far more commonplace result of frustration, is not in any positive human direction. You will find that it expresses itself more negatively in hostility, aggression, and very often in violence. If you look, for example, at a lot of the young people who were the young unemployed, who are finding their way into the National Front movement and that sort of thing, you have those sort of indicators that there is a lot of rebellion about, but anti-authoritarianism and rebellion does not necessarily find its way into political channels which are positive and constructive. They more often than not find themselves channeled into political outlets which are destructive, hostile, and aggressive, I'm sorry to say.
Does anybody want to express a different view to that?
The CND and the National Front.
You've got men now who are able to express the caring side of their nature. They never worked 50 years ago. You've got the homosexuals who can, say they love each other. You've got men able to embrace their sons that they couldn't do at one time. They're not being aggressive. And I think there are more of the gentle side of people's characters is coming out, despite everything that's against them. I think it's more obvious to them.
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously. I mean, I know one thing, 40,000 children die every day of starvation or hunger-related illnesses, and nobody cares a damn. It doesn't even get mentioned in the press. If you want to find the figure, you've got to go to some obscure report of UNICEF for last December.
Yes, but Peter, you
and,
did find
And it doesn't find a square inch in the Daily Mail.
But Peter, you did find these figures. And 50 years ago, they weren't even recorded. So, people aren't becoming aware of them. People are going back into these things.
I mean, the social contradictions of 20 million unemployed currently in Europe and America alone, in a world which is desperately crying out for more wealth. And if you have a look at the trade unions, for example, I think they're appalling. The level of ideas which is expressed by trade unionists in general is sterile, and they're in the same dead-end cul-de-sac that they ever were, more so.
But wouldn't that show itself more and more as the depression gets worse and worse? Wouldn't that make people think? I think the whole idea of people not thinking, they're afraid that they couldn't understand it if they did think. That it's been led by the nose all the time, they expect to be led by the nose.
Yeah, I think, Comrade Coleman, you want to come in, yes?
Well, I just want to say, look, Peter Lawrence is just exemplifying his own argument that the more frustrated people become, the more negative they get. He's doing it himself. Look, I mean, this is, as was said just, these notions about optimism and pessimism and how you feel about it, this is absolute idealistic nonsense. It's quite unbecoming to this historical material, just to sit around thinking about these things, we are supposed to, as far as possible, be making a serious analysis of the development of society and the ways in which society can develop, the options which are open, the scientific options, so to speak, in terms of cause and effect, how the problems of society can be resolved. Now, quite frankly, I don't believe for one moment that the speaker has done a head count to discover whether more people who are frustrated join destructive movements than ones which see themselves as being positive. Of course, all movements which support capitalism are, in that sense, destructive. They're all supporting the system which are perpetuating the cause of all of these problems. We know that, but at the same time, what you've got to ask yourself is what it is that people are thinking about in society at the moment. What, not to analyse human ideals in the terms of those ideals. That is the most basic philosophical mistake you ever make, to look at an ideal which someone has and to judge it within the terms of that ideal. What you have to do is to look at the hopes and the movements and so on that are going on in society, and to try to see them within, as far as we can, the terms of historical objectivity. In other words, not the feelings and the short-term hopes of the people involved in them, but the long-term pattern, so to speak, of the way in which these problems which give rise to these hopes and these fears and so on can be resolved. And all you can say is that there are only two possible prospects for humanity. One is socialism, and the other one is a continuation of capitalism. Within the continuation of capitalism, I suppose you can say that there are two possibilities there. Either capitalism carries on its destructive path to the point where it destroys us all, or capitalism continues along its destructive path to the point that it just continues creating a miserable, unsatisfactory existence for people who live in capitalist society, and primarily for the majority class in capitalist society, the working class. That is all we can say. We can only look at it in those objective terms. Now, as for what people do about it, if you are really committed to the view that workers can't see through capitalism, that, to use your phrase, because I wouldn't put words into your mouth on this, where you say absolutely nothing has happened to make workers see the contradictions of capitalism. If that is really true, then obviously you would be wasting your time, and we would all be wasting our time, in engaging in the process of trying to intervene in the way people see society and try to make persuade people to choose the socialist outcome for society rather than the destructive capitalist one. So if you were committed to that view, it wouldn't only be negative or pessimistic, it would be the most positively anti-socialist view you could reach. Because the answer would be, you pack up, you don't bother to have a socialist party, and you don't bother to engage in discussion or to work on the basis of assuming that there is going to be change in society. But my analysis of capitalism, and I'd say this is a much more basic Marxist analysis of capitalism, is that experience of capitalism teaches workers more and more of what the system is about. But that knowledge doesn't always take the form that you think it might. In other words, just because the Socialist Party of Great Britain has a very clearly defined and coherent conception of what capitalism is and how it exploits and causes problems for workers, it doesn't mean that workers will necessarily reach that knowledge in precisely the same way. That knowledge, the process of achieving that knowledge, is something which is very hard to predict. But what I would say is that there is considerable evidence that workers are achieving that knowledge, that the knowledge of the fear of destruction, the problems which exist in society, are all around us. And it's a very insular and quite a dangerous view, I would say, if you imagine that just because the Daily Mail doesn't publish a fact that kids are dying of starvation every day, that people don't know about it. Apart from the fact that it's a pretty ethnocentric view of looking at society, because if you live in Africa or Asia or Latin America, you don't need to read the bloody Daily Mail to know that kids are dying of starvation, because you are there. And it's not only going to be Daily Mail readers who create a socialist revolution, it's going to be people who are there as well. But apart from that, you don't need to read about the fact that there are people unemployed, because the people who are unemployed are the first ones to hear about the fact that there's unemployment around. You don't need to read about the fact that there is people who are homeless or whatever else it is. So don't be quite so pessimistic about this. I'd say if you want to look at optimism and pessimism, the best way to look at optimism and pessimism in history is look at how the ruling class are viewing society. And if the Socialist Party of Great Britain is feeling frustrated, the ruling class over the last 100 years, the one characteristic point that comes out of all ruling class contemplation about their own position is one of frustration, because they think that they're losing their grip. And that is not an illusion on that their part. That is a fact. That is a fact of history which is coming through in precisely the same way as over the closing decades of feudalism and the closing decades of slave society, the ruling class began to apprehend its own downfall and could do absolutely nothing about it. Precisely the same problem is happening in capitalism now. There is a massive lack of political confidence on the part of broad sections of the international ruling class. In the whole of the state capitalist bloc, they are fearing for the first time how long they're going to retain their grip. A few years ago, there was a book published, some of you may have read, what was it, Will the Soviet Union Survive Until, when was it, 1984, whenever it was. In Russia today, they're beginning to have to run special classes in the schools because kids are beginning to oppose militarism for the basic reason that they're the ones who are going to have to go out there and get killed. They know that from their own experience. All over Europe, the education system is having to become more and more geared towards trying to perpetuate outdated moral and political beliefs, which they're finding very hard to knock into people. So I wouldn't want to exaggerate the extent to which the working class is moving towards socialism, but let's not see history in these idealistic terms of how many kids, I mean, as for the argument which Peter Lawrence put forward about kids joining the National Front, that is one of the worst arguments he could use in his defence, because the number of kids who joined the National Front are exceptions. It right from the start until the present day, it was a freak organisation of capitalism. It was the organisation of the most despairing minority within the working class. You could just as well say that the Jehovah's Witnesses have increased their membership during the course of the Depression. Who the hell cares about the Jehovah's Witnesses or the National Front or any of these freak extreme organisations who've got nothing to offer, no hope whatsoever to anyone, and they are about as meaningful as Comrade Slapper's talk about people committing suicide and therefore understanding more about society. It's idealistic nonsense.
Does anybody else want to come in on? I'm going to close down at 10 o'clock, Harry, is that all right?
Before they all ran away, could I remind you of the different time?
Well, I'll announce it, Harry, before it finishes.
Apart from that, may I add that the next lecture won't be by Comrade Moss, and Comrade Coleman has predated, because he'll be giving a talk about Marx and the anarchists, Marx's views on anarchism and the anarchists. That will be next Saturday on the 28th, Comrade Coleman, and we're making the time progressively earlier because of the dark.
I've just got one announcement. Apart from the fact that there is, for anybody that haven't got the current Socialist Standard, that is this month, it is on sale here. And any back numbers, really back numbers, you can have, take some with you if you like. And there are other standards and other literature that you can get, which is on sale at the back there. And for those who are interested, tea will be available in the canteen after the meeting. So is there anything, anybody else that wishes to make a contribution?
Can I just say just one small thing, really, that we in the Socialist Party know the solution, because we understand that the cause of the problem is being capitalism, and that gives us, in a sense, a tremendous advantage, whereas other people in the working class, they know the problems all right, but because they don't understand the cause of the problems, they don't know the solution. But when we look at people going over what we think of as blind alleys, we have to look at them with some sympathy and also with frustration, because we have to wait for them. We've already arrived at the position where we're ready to move on to socialism, but we have to wait till they get to that position. But as we already see the solution, that somehow adds to our frustration at looking at the people who haven't already realised the solution, but who are enmeshed in the problems. And I think that we have to view them with some sympathy. I don't mean that yet. I mean sympathy from the point of view of their struggle to find a solution. But we already know that. And I suggest that without getting into the pessimistic-optimistic argument, that we have absolutely no choice but to keep plugging away at what we know to be the solution. And partly because of that, but mostly because of their experience in capitalism, we will get to socialism, but that is the attitude that we have to take, that we will get there.
See, if anybody should be frustrated, we should be. I think we should have medals tonight. Right.
Now we enjoy it. Okay.
Well, Oliver, do you want to?
Phil, I was just mentioning point about the National Front, point about young people going to the National Front. Well, if you look historically at the sort of fascism of the last bit of black employment in the 1930s, you see that fascism was much bigger force than it was today. The response to unemployment was that more workers went into more extremes of Stalinism on one hand, and fascism on the other hand. These are violent political extremes. Whereas the response to this question, especially last year or two, growth of the National Front has been virtually nil. The National Front, that is spectacular. Of course, not that the fascism is pretty much fragmented at the moment. And I think most workers have come to become more sophisticated politically and they realize that fascism and Stalinism will not solve their problems. Another interesting development last couple years is the decline of the Labour Party, despite the fact that it's under the Tory government. Doubling unemployment, working class is not plucked back to Labour. So the Labour Party. So it's still fresh in people's minds. So unemployment and poverty grew in the last Labour government. And also, should I also recognize that the last couple of years, a few years, we've seen growth of other organizations, political organizations. The same two Marxists also hold the same vision of socialism as the SPGB about class as one in society. They have organizations from France, continent, like organizations like the ICC, Solidarity. You begin to question Leninist both, rather question Leninism altogether, and criticize some aspect of it, and come to a conclusion, which is similar to this, the idea that socialism is not in the society. It was up to about the 1960s, everybody realized that socialism was, everybody used socialism as either Labour Party reformers or reform measures or state capitalism. There was LDSBGB at the time hold this view of socialism. It seems to now become more awareness of what socialism means now. There's also more awareness about the nature of Eastern European and other so-called socialist countries. More people are becoming more sophisticated political analysis.
Well, look, if there is nobody that really wants to come in at this stage, I'll ask the speaker to quickly wind up. But if are there any questions that you want to ask him before he winds up? Okay, Peter, just want to...
Well, it's nothing much to reply to. I mean, of course, I go along with Comrade Deutz, and she echoed, in a way, with different words, what Steve was saying. Well, of course, we carry on. I think what I was articulating and trying to express was this extremely worrying situation which exists between social reality, the real causes of the vast human contradictions that exist in capitalism, and the actual consciousness of that reality in politics. There is a very, very wide gap indeed. And within that gap, almost anything can happen. And I think that's what really worries me. None of us know what's going to happen within capitalism. And I think the system is totally out of control. I mean, ideally, a rational society sets up social objectives which are in line with human interests and organises social resources in order to achieve those objectives. Capitalism is totally incapable of doing that. It just can't do it. And the reasons why it can't do it seem to occupy absolutely no hopeful place within popular social consciousness. And as I say, within that gap between consciousness and reality, in a situation which is out of control, well, anything can happen, and I think we all should be a bit worried. But on the main theme of the talk, well, I'm glad we've achieved a general agreement, and I think we should now give alienation its rightful place within the whole scenario of Marx's works. Thanks, Ken.